I guess the flip side argument of that, while I'm thinking about it to debunk it, would be like, just because you mash your own dick doesn't mean you have a desire to mash someone else's.
Yeah, and I think a lot of, like, sexual excitement doesn't come from the physicality of things. Like, a lot of it is, like, visual arousal and
okay, those kind of feelings. Okay, I do think that. It's the lights on phenomenon.
What's that?
Girlfriend or wife tells you, I want to do it with the lights off. They don't understand the concept that it's, like, guys are very visual.
I usually just close my eyes really tight.
Just hope that something doesn't happen. Something bad doesn't happen. From the incident? Have you started doing that from the incident?
No, I just don't want to pop early. Like, I don't want to get distracted if the TV's on.
You can always look elsewhere, but I want to have the option of being able to see.
Yeah.
Why don't you have all your, like, you're already involving, like, the sense of touch and everything like that. But, like, to have that visual element, too, is completely, like... To me, I mean, it's not 100% necessary, but if there's a light in the room capable of working and electricity is on, that light should probably be on, in my opinion. I don't know how we're going to segue this into what we're talking about.
No, and especially because my second thing that I was going to bring up was Antonio Inoki died, and that's very sad to me.
Who?
His name's Antonio Inoki. He's basically like, if Hulk Hogan... Vince McMahon and not George Bush, but like a famous politician mm-hmm. were all one person. That's who Antonio Inoki was in Japan. Like, the dude fought Muhammad Ali in like the first ever like MMA style match. Him and Ric Flair fought a match.
It was like one of those, not it's kind of a gimmick match, but it's not where it's like we're going to pit a boxer against.
A catch wrestler
or like a sumo wrestler or Greco-Roman. We're going to see which. It's what the USC initially started out as. Yeah. It was a way to determine what the most superior martial art was. And then people discovered, oh, you can't know just one. You got to know multiple disciplines.
They did this way back, like around Rumble in the Jungle time for mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali. And I think it was in the 90s, Antonio Inoki and Ric Flair wrestled in North Korea. Like, he also flew into Iraq and saved a bunch of people from Saddam Hussein, like a bunch of Japanese prisoners that they took. Mm-hmm. So he was a member of the Japanese house like two separate times. He invented New Japan Pro Wrestling, like the biggest wrestling organization over there. Mm-hmm. He just was the man. And he had a little dirt on him. He got kicked out of parliament the first time because they think he was taking money from the Yakuza and... It looks like he might have, but...
Around what time frame was this? I know if Ric Flair's involved, then it's obviously, like, 70s earliest, maybe 60s, 70s?
He fought... That's the thing, he wrestled for forever, too, but he was Muhammad Ali right around the 60s, and I want to say the North Korean match with Ric Flair happened in the 90s. So, okay. A very communist man, or a very communist country...
No, you're thinking China. Japan isn't a communist country.
No, but... They went to North Korea.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Like, North Korea allowed this dude in and Ric Flair in, like, at a very communist time. And I'm sure tensions between them weren't high. But it's just...
Dennis Rodman gets in there whenever he wants.
He's
Who
crazy.
Else is... No, Steven Seagal is buddies with Putin. Is there anyone else that's buddies with Kim?
Yeah, and I can't... It's somebody very...
Is it, like, obscure?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'm not going to be able to figure famous. It out. Okay, I guess this segues perfectly into it, because you're talking about a guy that was an entertainer. You're talking a man that was an innovator. A man that just wanted to please the people. Sounds like he was very successful at it.
One of my least favorite subjects in talking about, because I have zero respect for his occupation.
See, here's the thing, though. I think calling him a magician, which I think is what you're getting at here,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a proper term for him. I think magician is a blanket term for, I think it's because it has the word magic in it. So I think it's supposed to allude to magic. I think illusionist is, or performer is the more appropriate term, but those don't have like a gravitas to them. Magic makes you believe that there's something else. Illusionist just automatically says to you, oh, this is just something he's making me see.
That's fair. That would be a fair assessment of what Harry did. He just...
Harry who?
Harry Houdini.
Houdini!
Talking about again, following our episode last week on the Salem witch trials, all October we're going to be doing some fun spooky stuff. And
so aside from Harry Houdini, magician, illusionist, debunker of what's the
spiritualists,
when did he... I'm just gonna jump forward, we won't talk about this until we get there, but also tying into Halloween month, when did he die?
All Hallows Eve.
All Hallows Eve, baby.
October 31st.
All right. So, Harry Houdini was actually born Eric Weiss. So, he was born in Budapest, Hungary. He was Jewish. He was born to a Jewish family. His father was a rabbi, but from all I've heard of him, he was not a good rabbi.
How are you a bad rabbi?
From what the information that I kind of went over was, he, I don't think he was necessarily like a bad rabbi. His method of, his style of congregate is not, it's not congregate. His style of preaching or that kind of stuff, or his way he went about it, they said it was very inflexible and it was really rigid. So if you came into an area, like when they moved and everything, he came into, a Jewish church, but I think they maybe wanted to do something a little bit different, focus on different things. And he was just really rigid in the way that he wanted to do his teaching. And it's kind of expected though, because I mean, they came from like
Hungary.
I mean, that's, you know, Europe in that situation is going to have people that are very just traditionally like hardcore Jewish.
Then I wondered, just because it was so much earlier, I don't know if Jewish people have ever had it, like, good. Like, I don't think they've ever been, like, a preferred people. So
they have had it rough.
Yeah. Back then, even before, like, pre-World War I, World War II, Hungary probably wasn't a great place for them. And that's why I'm sure coming to America was probably going to be something that they hoped for, a new start. To end up in Appleton, Wisconsin, though.
That's because I think that there's a large... It has something to do with there being like a large German Jewish population there too. Because isn't that the big thing, is that like kind of the Wisconsin, Minnesota, doesn't that have like a German populace living there? Maybe I'm thinking of like Ohio or...
No, I think they probably do, because they do a lot of the same things well.
Yeah.
So there has to be some sort of an influence coming from Europe as far as looking at that section of the country, because they do beer really well. Mm-hmm. Germans do cheese really well. And just kind of like when we talked about the Vikings, I think there's a lot of like that Nordic kind of influence, but I think
there's a lot of German influence too. Like old German influence there. So he was born earlier than I thought, with his still how prevalent his name is.
Way earlier.
Yeah, way earlier than I thought. So born in March, on March 24th, 1874.
That's,
I mean, for what's more impressive about saying that date and how long ago it was, is when we're going to start talking about the illusions and the tricks and how kind of he's like a, you know, if you have those people that are like the top of their fields or come along in history, that it just like that person finds themselves exactly what they're supposed to, you know, doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Tesla, theories with like, electricity and all that kind of stuff. Tesla was supposed to be doing that. His brain was just wired like that. Houdini, this is what he was meant to do. And the way that he did it is why people still, I think it's why magic and illusionists are still even around today.
It could be. I think that he was a master of an opportunity that like wasn't there, because we'll get into how he started, but before he started breaking into his illusions, there were still card tricks, there were still parlor tricks, there was still all these different...
escapism.
Mm-hmm. There was all these different things that they could do to garner an audience. Where
one thing led to another, though. He always progressed. Like, he didn't just wasn't satisfied just doing the card tricks, which they said he wasn't even that good at. He was excellent as an escape artist, but he always just kept progressing, is what I'm saying. I think if you're not meant to do something, you hit a ceiling, and then that's why your name isn't known.
Yeah, I think that it could be it. I think his desire to be different from everybody else led to doing a bunch of different things that people hadn't really thought of yet.
All right, so walk me through Eric's childhood.
Like we said, they came over from Budapest. He was 4 years old at the time. They were in Appleton, Wisconsin. And like Chris said, his father was a rabbi, so he grew up probably in a fairly strict home. Rabbi Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
First name was Mayer, kind of sick.
Were his parents German? I know that he was born in Budapest and everything, but Steiner and Weiss are both, I believe, traditionally German names, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know when the Ottoman Empire and all that shit was popping off over there, but I'm sure that Hungary is fairly probably pretty close to Germany.
Yeah.
So they probably were.
It's Europe. It's the size of a large mall.
Everything
just connects.
Size of Texas. They were in West Texas. Germany might have been East Texas. Yeah,
there you go.
They really just did not have a great life to that point, and it took them a long time. After Rabbi Mayer got run out of Wisconsin, they ended up going to Milwaukee, and Milwaukee was just worse. They lived in squalor. They didn't.
Milwaukee is in Wisconsin, isn't it?
Yeah, but not Appleton.
Oh, not Appleton. Okay, gotcha.
So they moved to a bigger hub, hoping to find more work.
Did you know Milwaukee is actually Algonquin for? It's pronounced Milwaukee,
and it's Algonquin American?
And it's the good land or the great land. Yeah. That might be true. I'm quoting Alice Cooper from Wayne's World that said that, but I think it's actually factual.
Yeah, I'm sure there was plenty
Milwaukee,
of Algonquin.
Milwaukee. That's
a lot of Algonquin tribes there, I'm sure. But they didn't have two pennies to rub together at this time. Dad couldn't get work. And they ended up having to...
It was a big family.
It was him.
Five other kids. I think it was five or six.
Really?
So, I mean, you're moving this entire family over from your homeland. That to me is a recipe for struggle. That's the American story right there, man.
Oh, yeah. Especially to a small town, like with less opportunity than there would be in a place like Milwaukee, which I'm sure is probably where the natural progression was. You move to a bigger city, hopefully there's more opportunity. They ended up running into zero opportunity there. So Harry and his dad went ahead and shipped off to New York.
It's Eric. No. That's right. Okay. The discovery of his name, what he ends up taking as. So when they got to Ellis Island to get checked in and provided their names, they changed their names to Weiss. They think they took the Z off the end, and it was W-E-I-S-S. And then they changed his name from Eric, E-R-I-K, to...
Ari, wasn't it?
Erich. Like, however, it's E...
With a C-H?
Yeah, but there was an... the way they spelled it was weird. It was like E-H-R-I-C-H. But he went by Ari. So he was Ari Weiss. So now you're going to start finding where Ari becomes... Doesn't Ari sound just like, oi, Ari?
It sounds like Harry Potter.
Yeah, exactly. Oi, Ari. So that's how it ends up becoming Harry.
And he ended up being more of a wizard than we all gave him credit for.
Do you think that's why J.K. Rowling picked... Ooh. Okay, keep going. I'm gonna look that up to see if that
was why
she named the character Harry Potter.
I don't know how to feel about J.K. Rowling without sounding mean.
I focus strictly on... It's the...
You separate the art from the artist.
It's the widely recognized Michael Jackson phenomenon. He was a garbage fucking human being, but his song, like, I try to, it's weird to say, but like, I'll hear a song come on, and if it's not one of like the top hits, I'm like, no, I'm not gonna let it. But like, if it's Thriller, I can respect the art that is Thriller without paying homage to the artist, I guess.
I think that's probably fair, but excuse me. As they got into New York, Papa Mayer found himself working in a tie factory, and he got young Harry a job there, young Harry a job working in the same factory. They saved up enough money to where they could send back and they could bring in all the family that was still in, Milwaukee, living in squalor. And their situation didn't really improve much when they got to New York. It was just more livable.
Was it just the two of them moving there, or did they end up bringing the family?
They brought the family after they'd saved enough money. So they did find work, which was great. And Harry really finally found the stage at 9 years old. And that's when.
How long do you think it took you to get from Wisconsin to New York in that time?
Oh, by train? Probably a week.
It was train, right?
It would have had to have been, because they didn't have airplanes yet.
Yeah.
And cars weren't really a
thing. I want to find some place that does like a train tour in the U.S.
Yeah.
They used to do one up in like an hour outside of town.
Yeah. And then the rock slide happened. Yeah. But that's what I'm telling you. These YouTube videos that I watch, they take these trains across the country, and it's very cool.
I know.
Fun to watch.
Yeah.
You get in on those, you'll be good to go. You'll really want to go at that point. So after they bring all the family over, like I say, young Harry finds himself in the limelight finally as a trapeze artist, of all things.
I thought you were going to say he was a wizard. The way you said that was like a line from Hagrid. It's like, young Harry.
No, he was kind of a built dude. Like
he was jacked.
Yeah, well, in his totality of life, I think he only got up to like 5'5", which
I know, but he was jacked.
Yeah, he was a built dude. Mm-hmm. So being a trapeze artist, he's little, he's strong. Mm-hmm. They can probably fling him a long ways. Like, that's probably a natural progression for somebody, especially that wants to be an entertainer.
There was a situation before he really got started doing the Brothers Houdini, which he starts going with his, he teams up with his friend.
When Jacob Hyman.
I know. Breaking.
Well, that relationship breaks apart.
It breaks apart.
Yeah, they tear each other apart at that point.
So when he's 16, he teams up with his friend Jake Hyman, and he forms the Brothers Houdini. Now, the name Houdini, actually, he takes that as an homage to basically a French magician who inspired him named
Robert Houdin.
And I guess there was a tradition in Europe that when you were to homage someone by taking their name, you added an I to it. Weirdly enough.
Kind of like you're doing it for them.
Which makes me think, does that occur also, if it's occurring in Europe, does it occur in Italy? Was there a Leonardo da Vinci? And then da Vinci was his predecessor, the one after.
Protege?
No, maybe not even that. Like, he inspired Leonardo da Vinci. Maybe that was his, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll find that out if he did that when we do Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, here's a scary thought, too. Was there a Benito Mussolini?
Ooh.
I hope not.
Maybe it was a French thing, because Robert Houdin was French. So maybe the homage was in, because isn't homage a French word?
Yeah.
Okay, and so maybe that's what it was then.
I think that's where a lot of it comes from today, like when you see that still happening. Like, there's other acts now today that have an I at the end of it is like a...
That's true.
Something that Houdini did.
Do you realize that our way of doing that is like, Kobe, you shoot it? Like, that's kind of how we do stuff.
He'll live forever.
Mm-hmm.
So him and Hyman, like I say, they split. They break apart. And he brings in his younger brother. Do you remember the younger brother's name? I saw it a couple different times, but it was one of the other four or five that was in the family. They had a very short-lived run, though, because after him and his brother are hanging out doing these parlor tricks and all that kind of stuff.
Was it Nathan? He's got brothers, or Theodore, Godfrey, Leopold, Nathan, and Herman. It was Nathan or Herman, I think.
Okay. Yeah, we'll
go. Oh, Harry Houdini's brother. Oh, it was... No, that's Harry. Hold on. Oh, here we go. Harry Houdini's brother, Theodore, left his own career as a magician and escape artist. So that's who he teamed up with.
Teddy.
It was Teddy. I was thinking it was like, it had two syllables in it.
Teddy Houdini.
Is that a better name?
Teddy Houdini.
Fuck, that's a good name.
It rolls off the tongue well.
A sexier version.
Teddy Houdini. Baby, I'm
Teddy Houdini.
Harold Houdini wouldn't really work.
I have either. The famous disappearing sausage trick.
You want to see the disappearing fingers? Mm-hmm. like I said,
and for my next act, I'm going to disappear out your window before your husband gets home.
I swear this trick usually lasts longer.
My last audience was completely satisfied.
They end up breaking apart because Harry finds
Wilhelmina. Are you just trying to do as many Hyman like puns as you can?
I didn't even mean to that time.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, so they broke that virginity seal with the Hymans. Then Teddy comes along. Teddy gets kicked to the curb for his future wife, Wilhelmina Rayner, I think is her name.
Bess.
Yeah, Bess is just the easiest way. Wilhelmina. God, dude, could you imagine that name having a comeback? You don't name your kid Wilhelmina anymore, like, unless you hate them, I think.
Yeah.
Like, that's rough. You're going to go Willie for
a girl? That was back
in
the day when you would have literally just the same name, except there would be a boy version and a girl version. So it's Wilhelm, Wilhelmina, Georgia, or George, Georgiana.
That was what I forgot to bring up last week. I finally ran into my female junior scenario.
Okay.
Because there was a couple witches where their children's names were actually, like, Victoria Jr.
Ooh.
I've always wanted to see a female junior. Hmm. I don't know why that is, but there's something about that that just makes me think, like, we do that all the time for men.
Mm-hmm.
Why are there no female juniors?
Yeah. It's got to be a traditional thing, because when it came to naming the children back in the day, it was the men that got to pick the names or got final say on it. Can you imagine, like, sitting in, like, a fucking hospital like in the 1800s or whatever would amount to hospital at that point, and she's like, I would like to name him Stephen. The dad's like, oh, fuck that, he's taking my name,
Carl Jr.
Yep, Carl Jr. And then his kid, I'm gonna make sure, is Carl the Third. The Carls will live forever.
If we run into Carl the Fourth or the Fifth, we're doing things really well. It's like Ptolemy. That's probably where it came from.
That's the only way that Brad probably ever hung around.
Just
fuck that, honey, it's Brad.
That was probably...
I understand that could be problematic at home, but nope, we're dealing with it.
As far as we could spell, just give him four letters. So, Bess was, I believe he found her, she was singing in a quartet or something like that, and he really took a liking to her quick, and I didn't look at a lot of pictures of her. I don't know what the pictures would look like back then, but apparently she was somebody that he fell for pretty quick, and she really, in her own right, as his assistant... was very good at magic too. Mm-hmm. Like she was very good with sleight of hand. They had multiple different illusion acts where she had to play just as big of a part as Harry did.
And I think that's something that does get lost too, even nowadays, with so many magicians that do, you know, the famous ones. I guess this day and age would be like David Blaine, Tool. Chris Angel,
Tool,
used to be David Copperfield.
I don't know. Maybe Tool.
I went and saw David Copperfield. David Copperfield. David Copperfield live when I was like, maybe like eight to 10. And I'm going to tell you right now, that shit will blow your fucking mind as like as a small child.
I'm sure it will now. And I'm sure it would just make me angry because I couldn't understand how
the trick that he did, the one that I've remembered my entire life, was he got on stage. He rode a Harley on the stage. He rode into a box, and keep in mind, this was, I think, at, I'm trying to remember, it was a smaller, not a small venue, not a small venue, but it was like an auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
So they raise the box up that he's in, and then it drops, and when the box drops and hits the ground, the box breaks open, there's nothing there, and at the same time as it breaks open, within a couple seconds, he rises out of the middle of the fucking audience, on the fucking revving up the motorcycle, and fucking... 8 to 10 year old me is just like, the fucking mind just is blown out of the back of my skull.
Magic is real.
Yeah.
Magic is real
that
point.
This guy's a fucking wizard.
Yeah, maybe he, because didn't he like disappear the Statue of Liberty or something like that?
Yeah.
Too?
But I mean, that's on TV. Like that.
It is, but it's still like a feat that made national
it
news.
It is, but like once you've seen like anything they do on TV now, you're just like, oh, maybe he was just ahead of the curve with like, you know, camera angles and shit like that.
Could have been. The two fellas in Siegfried and Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Siegfried and Roy had a great stage show. I never saw it, but I've seen snippets of how it all worked. Like, their pageantry was
That's what it is. It's pageantry, and it's the show with, like, Houdini and Bess. I think people kind of getting back to my original train of thought. With assistants, assistants are such an integral part of the show because a lot of this being like sleight of hand and illusion tricks, it's to draw your attention away. That's why it got to the point where a lot of the assistants were wearing like swimsuits and skimpy outfits and stuff, because it was meant to catch your eye while they were trying to do part of their trick. If you could focus your attention here for just a split moment, you wouldn't be focusing on, you know, the magician.
Well, and it seemed like it was also kind of like a failsafe for a lot of the things that he did. Like, we'll get into a lot of the escape tricks that he did, mm-hmm. where she was kind of an integral part in making sure that he had everything that he needed to pull the trick off.
Mm-hmm.
But basically around this time, they're just working small rooms. He's doing a lot of sleight of hand stuff. The thing that really gets them discovered, though, is I think the guy's name was Beck. His last name was Beck.
Yeah.
And he ran into Harry as he was doing a handcuff escape.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it well enough to really get this dude's attention. And he was like the guy for vaudeville.
Yep. He was like the largest vaudeville manager. And vaudeville, in case anyone's not familiar with it, it used to be an old form of performance. It was kind of like comedy theater, I guess.
A little bit.
Yeah. It was just kind of like what you would consider maybe like dinner theater, stuff like that. So you'd have these acts that traveled all over the country, these vaudeville acts. And this guy kind of was the cream of the crop as far as that went. Did you hear before he figured out he could do handcuff tricks, how he discovered he could do handcuff tricks?
Uh-uh.
So there was a situation where he was at like a locksmith or something. His dad may have had something to do with like being a locksmith or had worked for one. But a cop showed up with a suspect and the key for the cop's handcuffs had broken off inside. And Harry was able to pick it with a piano wire.
He picked a lock with
the piano wire? He picked a lock with the piano wire.
Wow.
And he figured out he could do that. And so as he started to craft his act and everything, he started incorporating that so much so into his act that part of his, I don't know if it was prior to or after he gets hooked up with Beck, the manager, he would invite, whenever he would stop into towns, he would invite like the police from that city to bring their best handcuffs or best set of shackles or restraints. And then he would, as part of his, you know, stop in that town, he would pick the locks and everything, which he always did behind a curtain.
Mm-hmm. It was never in front of everybody.
It was never, but you know, he would go behind the curtain and then all of a sudden the curtain would reveal him and he would be standing there holding the shackles and hand them back to him.
Yeah. That got him in some very deep trouble overseas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw that story.
Well, he got to the point where he got so good at it, he would actually actively seek out, like, the police in the towns and go to the police stations and be like, you guys want to try to lock me up?
We'll get to that. It was a very cool way to legitimize what he was doing, I think. But this Beck fella tells him, hey, I think it was come to Ohio, something like that. It says, be on the first train, be over here. I'm going to pay you a very substantial amount of money, more than they were making at the time. If I like what you're doing, then I'm going to sign you up for basically all next season. You're going to be my act for all of next season. And after they had gotten in good with this Beck guy, Harry started to work on his own, kind of like he would make his own cuffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they would all have sort of different niche tricks to it. Like there were some cuffs that he would invent to where if he was holding them vertically, they would be locked. But as soon as they went upside down, the latches would release and that would be his trick to get out. Or it would be like almost like a rubber set of cuffs where he could just slide his hands out, but they still look legit. And he had this penchant to want to do this stuff, but he didn't want to patent anything because when you file for a patent,
you got to explain how it works.
Yeah. And he didn't want any of those secrets getting out, even though it was patented, there's still a knockoff version that you could make of all these things.
He got around that though. There was a trick that he was able to patent. I'm trying to remember exactly which one it was. It might've been the milk can, but what he did is he patented it as a play or performance. So he got around the patent, having to patent the actual trick itself, which is a crazy thing to even think about, but it makes complete sense. you are an artist, you perform a certain thing, you don't want anyone copying your act, and so there's this rule in place that if you patent it, you own it, so someone could try to buy that off you, which was crazy that that was a thing in magic too, and illusionists, they would buy tricks off of each other and be able to perform that trick for a while. I guess that's akin to a musical act allowing another band or musical act to perform their songs or to cover their songs.
Yeah, it's like a comedian ripping off somebody else's joke.
But having permission to do so.
Well, the way that he did it was pretty ingenious. And like you were talking about, he would do it in an act like a stage show,
mm-hmm.
but he would do it in front of audience members.
When he patented the act, though, as a play or performance, he did it in front of one person, and he only had to do it in front of one person in order to get the patent on the act. After that, then he just went back to performing it as normal.
Yeah, it wasn't a patent, though. It was copyright.
That's right.
So since he copyrighted it, he had witnesses that said, we saw him do this on this day.
That's right.
So once mm-hmm. it becomes copywritten, and later on when they started to develop film or mm-hmm. started to develop films, that would be a way to do it because he would do it during a performance and it would be filmed. So they would have verifiable proof like that he was the one that copywrote that trick.
Well, I'm kind of curious because I see the tricks that you have up there as his most famous ones, which they are. It's the milk can escape. And then what we'll cover a little bit more in depth is called the Chinese water torture cell. Prior to that, he did an entire just like array of tricks where a lot of them involved him being shackled and restrained by like handcuffs or shackles, placed into something, whether it be like a burlap bag and then into a box, which was then like sealed and then like submerged in water. He did one trick where he was put into a bag, shackled, put into a bag. The bag was then put into a box, sealed. Then they lowered him on a crane off the side of a ship into the water. And then when they brought him up, when they started like during the allotment of time or when they received the signal to pull him up, he was standing on top of the box as they lifted it out. The box was still closed with the shackles inside.
And he, so
can you imagine how big he would have been had this been something when they're having to tour? And the only way that you see something is going to see it live. Like, can you imagine living in a society like that? How rich your experiences are that you've seen not live, but on like TV or have heard about, read about things like that. This is a time when the only way you're really seeing something is you have to go in person and you might read about the trick in like a newspaper, but it's not going to paint you the picture.
You couldn't explain this stuff to people.
No. And that's the thing is like, this is the first time there's never been like a precursor to this. So when you're seeing this kind of stuff, it's just got to blow your fucking mind.
Well, and so getting into his two things, and it explains how he does the Chinese water torture cell. But his first trick that he hit it big with was the milk can escape, like you were talking about.
And this is not a traditional milk can, mind you. This is like an industrial-sized milk can. So think of the shape of a standard milk can and then just like enlarge it. So he was able to shimmy in through the top. Did it tell you how he did the milk can escape, too?
I didn't see the milk can escape. But basically, the explanation for that was after being handcuffed, he was closed inside the milk can that had been filled over and over the brim by pails of water. And then as the curtain was drawn, the audience would attempt to hold its breath along with him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the part where I just don't understand how humans work. In the beginning, when he started doing this trick, it would take him about 30 minutes to escape. How do you have that much water or air to be able to be under for 30 minutes?
That can't
minutes?
Be accurate.
Yeah. He got so good at it that he cut it down. He was able to do it in 3 minutes flat.
Okay. But when he was performing it in front of people, he wasn't performing the 30-minute version. This was just when he was workshopping it, right?
No, he would be out there for 15, 20 minutes
okay,
at a time.
Okay, the only thing I can
done.
Think of then in that situation, if that's true, is when they were filling up the milk can right as they went to seal it. What I'm thinking is right as they went to seal it. Cause like, if you're thinking about like, think when you take like a big piece of ice and you dunk it into water, it'll overflow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm thinking maybe right at the last second, as they were getting ready to seal it, maybe he could like submerge a little bit more in the water. Because, like, if he's in the thing and the water buckets are getting full, he could displace a little bit more water and get it out. Maybe also the lid wasn't sealed, like, airtight or watertight. So when he was in there, if he tried to displace some more water, it could come out the top, which is then going to open an air pocket in the top, maybe where he could kind of, like, breathe for like a couple minutes.
If just catch another breath to go
exactly, because he was able to hold his breath for like 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah,
and so if he could get up there, and I'm not saying, you know, it wouldn't be bad because you're breathing in at that point more carbon dioxide, but if it's not airtight and watertight again, there's some air getting in there. But the simple fact that he could do it in a, you know, a milk can, being restrained, having to get himself out of it, you know, it's still something impressive. That was never seen. Yeah, it was never seen.
And sort of what you were talking about, this sort of leads into what the Chinese water torture cell was. It says Houdini would leave to change as his assistants filled the tank with heated water, which, right, heated water, don't really know what that would be.
It would, your body wouldn't seize up. Like, if you're in cold water, your body just initially wants to wrap itself, your arms around, just to try to keep you warm.
True.
Warm water is going to allow, think of getting in a hot tub. You
won't panic as fast.
It's easier to hold your breath in warmer water. Real quick, while you're right before you read that. So the water torture cell was basically, it's been in a bunch of movies.
Yeah, I have the full explanation of that too.
If you've ever seen the movie The Prestige, the one with Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale, where they're like competing magicians, there's a form of the water torture cell in there. And I think it actually might be how one of it's how Christian Bale's wife in the movie, I think, dies. If she doesn't get out of it in time, she's trying to do the trick. But it's basically, think of a glass box, and then at the time, because you have to have a steel frame around it to hold it in, and then it'd be filled with water, you'd be submerged, and the lid would be closed.
Yeah, so this again, man had some money from doing what he did, because it says,
well, at one point he was making $300 to $400 a week, which was the equivalent weekly of making like $1,900.
A good amount of money. And back, I think, then, that was the vaudeville days too, because that doesn't compare to this. So the cell was custom made for about $10,000, which today equivalents, that would be about $260,000 to make this thing.
I'm pretty sure that some magicians, probably like the well-known ones, like for the Chris Angel, like crazy tricks that he does that get televised. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure those illusions and everything cost a lot of money to make.
Well, when you have advertisers and all that kind of money, it's nothing.
This trick is brought to you by Doritos.
Well, he didn't have any of that. He did copyright it after he became fed up with the imitators that would also try the escape tricks. With a mahogany and nickel-plated steel frame and brass plumbing fixtures, it looked like an aquarium turned on its side. The torture cell weighed 7,000 pounds and held 250 gallons of water. It was disassembled into several portable pieces, as he always traveled with a second case, in case something happened to the first.
Do you think they ever ran into a situation when they were on stage getting that thing full up and the stage couldn't take the weight?
Well, yeah, it was heavy enough. They didn't have steel stages back then.
Yeah, it was made of steel glass that had to be thick enough to hold the pressure of the water. Plus, what you're saying is, how many gallons was it?
250.
Times 8?
Why times 8?
Because that's how many pounds are in a gallon of water.
Oh.
250 times 8. 250 times 8. That's a ton.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering how many stages, because that could actually hold up to that.
So it says, Houdini would leave to change, his assistants filled the tank with heated water, like we said. Returning in a swimsuit, the magician would lie on his back at the center of the stage. As assistants put his feet in mahogany stocks, after pulleys lifted him into the air upside down, he was lowered into the tank head first, and the stocks acted as a lid padlocking to the tank shut. So that was the first layer of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were padlocks that were attached to the top of the tank.
Okay.
So even if he was able to escape the hand shackles and the foot shackles, he was going to have to be able to get out of the tank.
Just so I know, with this one, was this one done behind a curtain?
Yeah.
Okay. So why would you, I guess it's for the theater of it. I was like, why? Because the milk can, once he goes in there, they couldn't see anything because it's a milk can.
Mm-hmm.
With this one, they could get him in it. The people could watch the entire time of him getting in there and see him actually submerge, see him in the water. But then they would cut, you know, they would
throw
lift the sheet and everything.
Yep.
So I'm guessing, though, that because there was a padlock on the outside, there would be a place for him to reach up through the lid to try to work the padlock. There had to have been, if his feet were out of the stocks, he could probably reach up through the holes where his feet were, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So it says, as an assistant was on standby with an emergency axe, just in case. The drapes were pulled shut around the glass, and the orchestra played Asleep in the Deep to help entertain the idea of a possible failure or death. 2 minutes later, Houdini would burst out to the applause of the baffled audience, with the stocks were still at the top of the tank and the locks were still in place. So
how do you do it? You said it tells you how he does it.
So he...
Fast forward if you don't want this ruined, I guess. Is this us breaking the magician's code? Is that a thing if we're not magicians?
No, because it's all over the internet. It's okay. Easy to find that stuff. All right. Yeah, and I never adhere to a code of magicians. While Houdini gave the illusion that he was sealed inside a cell totally filled with water, there was actually a pocket of air, just like you were talking about, the milk can at the top, between the stalks and the water surface. So he was able to get up there and get air when he needed to make that happen. The mahogany boards that formed the two sides of the ankle stalks separated slightly when the hasps were locked. So he had enough wiggle room to where even though it looked like it could lift him.
So he's
like
having to keep his feet flexed basically to hold himself in. And as soon as the curtain goes up, he just points his toes up and he drops into the tank.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you get a little bit of wiggle out of there. As the curtain was drawn, Houdini used the tank sides to push his body upwards while applying strength to his feet or to get his feet free. Like you were talking about twisting sideways. He could now bring them through the stock holes into his chest. He would then flip, take a breath in the air pocket before opening the stock boards from the sides, which were hinged instead of just locked. So they just looked locked. And then he would climb out.
Ah, hinges. Yeah. A magician's best friend.
Best trick in the book, a hinge.
False door.
Yeah, so then he would pop out. He'd close the hinges. They'd pull the curtains. Everybody goes nuts. So there was still an amount of skill to be able to make the illusion happen.
That's almost like the brilliance of it.
Yeah,
you have to not only have the mind, you have to design the trick.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think of, like, not only do I have to design this trick, but I have to design it in a way that it works how I want it to work, but then no one else knows how it works.
And it has to work every time I do it.
Yes.
Like, there's not a lot of room for error at this point, which they did say there was a lot of times where when he would do these tricks underwater, they would have a lot of people around because there were times when he would run short of air and he would start to turn blue or he would start to inhale water. Well,
the thing about his tricks, too, is that they had to stand up to scrutiny because he would allow people to come up and inspect and look at the tricks to determine how they were working. That's why he was so famous, is because these people would try to figure out, you know, these are, of course, like mostly common people, but they would go to try to figure out how these things work and they couldn't come up with an explanation of it.
Well, and one of the things that they didn't know, and getting back to Bess, is they would carry around, like when he would be doing these handcuff tricks and he would invite people up, they would inspect the cuffs and inspect the key. Mm-hmm. And as Harry would see the key, he would hand the shackles over to Bess. They had a big ass key ring that had, like, there was only probably maybe like 100 key combinations then. Like, it was all very basic.
Yeah. Lock and tumblers, like the pins and tumblers were not very. Oh, I'm thinking like. Like, remember what you would see as, like, old handcuff? It was like a fork.
Yeah, it's just two prongs that have to fit.
Or if you look like an old school, like, medieval key, it's literally just, like, the key, and then it has the thing that points down.
A single prong.
A single prong, yeah.
So, whichever one would still be holding the shackles, the other one would go diving for a key. When they would find the key, either him or Bess would palm it, or they would figure out a way to conceal it. They would hand the guy back his key, or sometimes they would hand the guy the dummy key.
That's how I heard it, is they would find a key that looked close enough to the one that they showed, because they would make them show the key to make sure that the shackles, they would make them, if someone brought shackles, they would make them demonstrate that the shackles were functional. Because I wonder if they ever ran into a situation where someone tried to, like, pull a fast one and make it to where there wasn't a way to, like, not that there wasn't a way to unlock it, but it wasn't the key that unlocked it. It was like a trick or something. And then he wouldn't know how to do it. And he would, you know, be like found out. Like
they were welded shut or something.
Exactly. So they would have to prove that they worked. And so what I heard from what you were saying is that, like, they would look at the key and then he would slip after they're showing him the key. He would then be getting their attention, slip Bess the key. She would go through this ring of keys that they had, find a one that was similar, that looked close enough. She would then give him that key. He would pass off the false key. They would be holding the key in their hand and be like, oh, my key's right here. And then Bess would pass him the real key for him to use.
And they did it in just a litany of ways. There were some situations where he actually had a little box, like trap door, in the heel of his boot.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd be able to hold a key in there if it was one of their sets, or if it was, like, we're talking about, like, a spectator that brings it up.
Mm-hmm.
He would always ask a kiss for good luck. And as the kiss happened, Bess would pass him the key from mouth to mouth, which, again, not magic, but a very, like, sleight of hand, like, impressive feat to do, and
which has been done, which is crazy up. Because that's been done in, like, I've seen TV and movies where they pass them the key through the kiss. There was an instance where this, I don't know if it was a police, it might have been a police department, brought in not only cuffs but, like, the leg shackles and everything too, and got him locked up in there. I think there's a picture of it. It's like where the one where he's, like, bent over, and I think he's got the handcuffs, and then there's also a chain going down to his feet. And the key for this thing was a 6-inch key.
Ooh.
And so they know that there wasn't a possible way. And he got out of them and everything. But they know that there wasn't a possible way for them to do the key switch during this, because they had made these cuffs specifically with, like, this custom key. So there was no way that they could have passed them. They wouldn't have known. So they couldn't have, like, had a 6-inch key that looked just like that to fool them. And he still managed to get out of them.
You sure he wasn't hiding it in, like, his magician's prison pocket?
his the Mother Nature's hat.
Bez ever leaned
Mother
over.
Nature's wizard hat.
Bez ever leaned over. She's like, "Hey, this key's too big for me to pass in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna have to shove it in your ass." He's like, "What? How thick is the key?
you want to keep up the charade or not?"
So, going back to the people trying to fool him, there was a time over in Germany where he was invited by the police department to come try to break out of one of their new state-of-the-art prison cells.
Mm-hmm.
He asked to go in and tour the cell first so he could check it all out, and they wanted to find the weaknesses, obviously. Mm-hmm. They probably wanted to see if they could fit up a key. Go in, very confident in it, come back out. Well, the German police said, "No, that's not the cell. We know this trick. We're on to you. We're going to put you in a completely different cell." So they slam him in another cell, and it takes him a little bit longer, but he's still able to break out. Immediately, the Germans seize on this and, like, "Yo, you have to explain this. Like, I forgot what the wording was, but it was like he made a mockery or something like that," mm-hmm. where they held him in court, and he had to go through this whole trial of, like, having to explain how he did it in order to mm-hmm. satisfy them. But all that did was give him credibility, because every single time he was able to do that and the police were like, "You shouldn't have been able to do that," it just furthered his star power.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can fool the general people, that's one thing. But if you can fool the police,
if you can escape from the people whose job it is to make sure people do not escape.
Yeah.
That's the thing, too, is, like, I don't think that they realized that this was his life. His life was trying to figure out places to get out of and to make them look good. I mean, I understand that people who are designing jails and prisons, their job is to develop a system that keeps people in, but they also have to think about other stuff like redundancies and, like, convenience and, like, functionality. All he had was the sole goal of trying to figure out where the weakness was, and he was a genius.
Yeah, I think we maybe didn't mention. No, we did mention it. Yeah, this guy had a third grade education.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he didn't go to Brown or Harvard or anything like that. Ooh. College episode be a good one.
Okay.
Like the history of college.
Oh, yeah.
But he wasn't an educated man. He grew up working in a factory trying to help his family out and didn't have more than a third grade education. So this guy is building his star power with not a lot of, like, academic or scholastic abilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are we ready to kind of get into the tail end of his life and his death and get into that stuff?
Yeah, do we want to go into how he died, and then we'll get into the conspiracy about how he died?
Yeah, I got to take a pee first.
Okay.
All right. All right, while we take a break from class and take care of some business, you can also take care of some business.
If you don't follow us on Instagram or Twitter already, our Instagram handle is historicallyhighpod, that's historicallyhighpod, and our Twitter is historicallyhigh, that's historicallyhi.
All right, and back to our show. All right, getting back at it. So this is kind of where Houdini's dislike of spirituality, I think, kind of either ramps up, or is this where it's kind of founded, or is this just where it really ramps it up when his mother dies?
It's not necessarily about his mother dying. It's what happens afterwards.
Okay.
And
so his father had passed at some point
fairly early on.
Yeah.
Like he was, I think, in his 20s when his dad mm-hmm. passed.
And then he made a promise to his dad to take care of his mother. Him and Bess are married at this point as well. They've gotten married. And there's a picture of him and Bess and his mother, and he's got his arms around both of them. It's like my two girls or something like that. So he was really close with his mom. So she ends up passing away. And was it like a couple years later? Was it pretty soon afterward that they had gone to the seance with that medium?
Well, this, I didn't know anything about this to begin with. So this was actually kind of odd but cool to meet up with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah, the guy that wrote the original Lost World, and didn't he also do Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah, he did all the Sherlock mm-hmm. Holmes. So, fairly well-known man at that point. He was very popular, and he was a spiritualist. And him and Harry were buddies. They did a lot of different things together, and I'm sure it was kind of like, hey, we're both famous. Let's mm-hmm. let's hang out. You're kind of the mystery writer. I'm kind of the mystery man. Yeah. So we go well together. And when Harry's mom passes away.
Do you think he ever based any of his writings or characters off of Harry? I don't know when his famous works were written. I know his famous works were Sherlock Holmes and then also The Lost World. But I don't know kind of the time frame for it.
No, and I would imagine hanging out with a guy like that, you're going to have to write about him eventually.
It's got to be inspiring, yeah.
Yeah. So, Sir Arthur's wife, Lady Doyle, performed a seance because I think at this point, Harry knew that, like, this was probably all mostly bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, you know, let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. And while Lady Doyle is performing the seance, it becomes very clear very quickly that it's just the most disrespectful thing ever.
Well, did you see what one of the examples was when he knew exactly when she was full of shit? Because it wasn't Lady Doyle that was performing. She invited them to the seance. Oh, she was the one performing it?
She was the one that was performing the seance. So
so she was the medium?
Yep.
Okay. So at some point, she says that she has channeled Harry Houdini's mom. And then she does the, what do you call that?
Sign of the cross.
Yeah, the sign of the cross.
For a Jewish woman who is not converted and would not be Catholic. Also, she wrote down something that she said that Harry's mom was telling her, and she wrote it in English, which Harry's mother never learned how to do. So she only spoke Hungarian mm-hmm. and whatever other languages. She never wrote anything in English, which meant that she never spoke in English, which meant that there was no translation that would have worked.
Which means if she was speaking to the medium, then the medium would have really understood her even,
mm-hmm.
unless translation is part of the power of the medium.
So absolutely full of shit at that point. And sorry, smoker's cough. One of the things that kind of struck me at this point, learning all that kind of stuff, was I feel like I would just immediately be pissed and probably be angry at Arthur for his wife just mm-hmm. basically disrespecting me.
Yeah.
But he was actually okay with it. Like, he just basically didn't want to bring it up. And it was really the needling of Lady Doyle saying that Harry, like, really took this to heart and it was really an important thing for him. Before he's like, no. That was bullshit. What mm-hmm. you did wasn't real. This is an issue. And Arthur really kind of took that as like, hey, man, that's my wife. Let's not disrespect her. Spiritualism is a real thing, which is probably one of the most outlandish things that anybody's ever said.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of put a divide in between them. But Harry, being a nice enough guy, didn't really want to put them on blast until they tried to bring him into their crazy circle, basically.
Well, and he had practice on this too. At some point prior to this occurring, didn't he write the book debunking and calling out Robert Houdin?
There was a little bit of that. Like he
actually came out with a book,
but it wasn't necessarily his spiritualism stuff. It was more of his magic tricks.
No, yeah, exactly. It was a debunking of him as a magician itself. Like, it explained all his tricks and how he was a fraud, which I kind of want to talk about that for a second, just trying to kind of put ourselves in the mind of that person. So this is the guy that you're actually, like, named after, that inspired you. Do you think it's a situation where, as he got better at being an illusionist and an escape artist and basically was honing this craft, all of a sudden, all the stuff that he looked up to Houdin for, he saw all the holes in it and saw how none of it was real or anything like that. Because obviously Houdini knows that none of this is real. It's illusions and, you know, trickery. But do you think he looked back and was like, Houdin was not even close to my level, and maybe...
He was ham-handed with his illusions, whereas I'm nice and crisp.
Yeah,
and...
like, is it something where he thought for a minute that by having the name Houdini, people were going to unnecessarily give credit for his talent to Houdin as the person that inspired him? And he was like, no, 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 no. This guy was an asshole. This guy was a fake. I'm Houdini. That's the only name there is.
Like he,
what would the reason be for just, cause this guy's dead. I think he tried to meet him once, didn't he? And they didn't meet, or did they end up meeting and he had a bad experience with him? Nope. He met with his wife.
He met with Bess.
No. He met with Houdin's wife. And there was some type of disagreement, or there was something that didn't go well about that interaction. And then he ends up just going scorched earth, just like he ends up doing on spiritualism.
That is one part, I think, of his personality, is he doesn't do anything to, like, he does everything to the nth degree. Like, there's no, like, holding back. Like, if you're in his crosshairs, he's going to fuck you up.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to steal his tricks, he's going to fuck you up. Like, he wants to be probably, I think,
when
like
it came said, to when it came to his craft, he was ruthless.
Well,
protecting his, essentially his intellectual property and all this.
I think it was probably with anything in life, because that's not just like a business acumen decision that you make. Like, you have to have some feeling behind doing that to people, and especially your mentor.
So in July of 1924, so Houdini meets with this famous medium. Her name is Mina Crandon.
Yeah.
So
you want to go into that stuff before we cover how he died?
Oh, no, we did. Yeah, we got it. Well, he's still alive during this, so let's wait. Let's do this, and then we'll cover how he dies.
Yeah, I guess we can kind of bounce back and forth.
So he brings scientists with him from, and an editor from the Scientific American, which was a publication at that point. I think it's got to be something like akin to Popular Mechanics.
Yeah, well, and Scientific American back then was like, hey, we have different shaped nails. Like, what does that look like back in the 1920s?
Yeah, no kidding.
Canned food, the newest revolution.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm just trying to think of all this stuff. Penicillin, is it right for you?
Yeah, penicillin, fungus or freedom?
Mm-hmm. So he brings essentially a crew with him, and they just destroy Mina Crandon. So Mina Crandon was famous as this medium. Was she the one that had the ability to, like, she said she had not telepathy. What's where you can move stuff with your mind?
Telekinesis.
She was, her claim was that she could move stuff with her mind. She had telekinesis. And so part of her act was set up wherever she did her thing, where stuff would be able to move on the walls with some type of, I don't know if it was a paddle system underneath her table where she moved paddles, but it would move stuff. And within, I think, like they said, 2 or 3 meetings with Mina, they were able to completely explain every single thing that occurred.
So he actually, for what Mina did, I think she was pretty good, because when he brought these guys from the Scientific American in this panel, they had created this, like, a challenge, I guess.
It's like a litmus test or something for telekinesis abilities.
Well, it wasn't necessarily telekinesis, because her whole grift was that she was able to talk to her dead brother. His name was Walter.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be able, like, she would hand him a megaphone and you would be able to hear it. Or he would be able to, like, ring a bell inside of a box that was on the ground, something like that. And one of the other really gross things that she did was she was able to excrete ectoplasm, in quotation marks with my fingers. Ectoplasm back then was literally just entrails that she would get from a butcher that she would pull from under her dress, or she would make it look like it's coming out of her nose. Like, fucking gross stuff.
Like witch doctor shit.
Well, yeah, and this is, like, pre-Hollywood.
Voodoo mama juju.
Mm-hmm. It's pre-Hollywood, so you've never seen anything like this before.
Oh, yeah. It's special. It's real special effects.
Yeah. So she was legit enough to where they were handing out this $2,500 prize for proof of like a psychic manifestation.
Yeah.
And they thought that she was the real deal. They thought that she was the one.
She went after it too, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like she knew best. So she kind of drew the attention to herself. It wasn't like they just went to her and were like, hey, we're going to pay you if you can do this. There was like an active search for people that could do this. And she responded to it, which I think is why Houdini was able to kind of hone in on her.
Well, they knew he was the one that helped set up the panel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure once they brought her to his attention, he's like, let's go get this bitch. So they show up there and they're like basically ready to give her everything. And he was so devout in trying to tear this lady down that he, for an entire day, he wrapped a medical bandage around his entire left leg.
Mm-hmm.
So it would go like numb. Mm-hmm. And then once you released it, it would just be super sensitive to touch.
Okay.
And he did this because he knew that when he got called on stage to be the assistant, because why would you not want Harry Houdini to be up there? Like, he's a major name to draw mm-hmm. your people in. He was able to feel her moving alongside his leg when she was running different props and
tricks. He was
just
trying to heighten it. It's like when you close your eyes in a dark room for a long time, then you open them, you can then make out some outlines and everything.
Yeah.
He figured out a way to just heighten his senses.
And she did kind of the same thing. She would put up it was called like a China curtain or some bad name like that. But she would do illusions behind this curtain, and he would actually feel like one of the things that she did was she would put a box on the ground, and then she would tell Walter the premonition, mm-hmm. her ghost brother, to ring the bell. And he could feel her legs sliding ever so gently along the floor where his foot was,
mm-hmm.
and then feel her actually kick the box underneath this table without anybody being able to see it. So he can tell, like, exactly what is going on, just word for word, line for line.
That's the thing, too, is, like, wouldn't you feel like if you were her, it's like you don't have a choice but to call him up, because if you don't call him up as the volunteer, then people are going to, it's going to look weird. You're not going to call up Harry Houdini.
Being questioned.
Exactly. The flip side of that is you're literally inviting up someone whose entire life has been dedicated to figuring out how to make people see things or believe things when they're not really there. It's basically, what do they call it? Reverse engineering. He's able to just sit there and reverse engineer her stuff.
Well, and he had known a little bit of this sort of grift before, because he had played around with these different things mm-hmm. early on in his act. So there were different things, like she would make a megaphone fly across the stage, and he could see that her husband was kind of like moving things in the background behind the China panel or whatever mm-hmm. they called it. And she would actually,
he's the Wizard of Oz, the guy back working everything, like all of the levers and the,
like, she would mm-hmm. set the megaphone on her head, and Walter, her husband, running the voice behind the screen, would say, where do you want me to throw this megaphone? Houdini would say, throw it at me. It would fly across the stage mm-hmm. and hit at his feet. Well, he realized that before any of this was happening, she was actually underneath the megaphone wearing it like a dunce cap.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that happened, she would lean her head forward. It would tilt off, roll towards him. Mm-hmm. Everybody would be like, oh, my God,
Walter. Just basic stuff, but stuff that someone so practiced at. Here's the other thing, too. This wasn't like a situation where it's you jump on YouTube and you can watch something and dissect it 50 times, and there's different camera angles. Most of the time, along with Houdini's acts as well, a lot of the people that are seeing this are seeing it one time for the first time. So it's like you're so amazed and you're caught up in the excitement that your brain almost doesn't let you question. You get to that, like, how did he do that? How did he do that? But your brain's not really asking, how did he do that? You're not trying to, like, work out the problem mm-hmm. in your head. You're just so amazed and in shock. It's almost like a reaction of saying, how did you do that? You're not even really trying to figure it out.
It's like watching somebody hit a fastball. Like watching somebody hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, there's so many questions that go through your mm-hmm. head, but you're just so in awe of what's going on in front of you that you can't break down, like, micro mechanics of how that swing catches up to that ball.
Exactly.
And after the second show that they went to, at this point, he had canceled like a week's worth of his own shows mm-hmm. just so he could show back up to Boston to see this lady's act again. And after the second one, he told the committee, he's like, hey, she's a fake. This is how it all works. This is what's going on. And you don't need to give her the money. So the Scientific American publishes an article saying, we're not going to give Mina the money because we can't for certain say that this is what she was doing. And this just pissed off the spiritualists. Like, they were so angry because she was kind of their lady. Like, she was their spiritual Jesus.
Well, not even that. It's just the fact that if Harry Houdini and, you know, the Scientific America are posting and reporting about this kind of stuff, it's getting to so many people. It's getting to more people than these spiritualists can.
Well, it's in a nationally publicated thing.
Exactly.
So it's ruining, like, her shows every time
you're the spiritualist, you're public access TV.
Oh, yeah.
Harry Houdini and Scientific America are national news. So you're able to, you know, they see Harry Houdini doing this. Somebody that doesn't have a knowledge of spiritualism is like, oh, I'm never looking into that. That's bullshit. Mm-hmm. You're able to, you know, sway somebody before they even have an opportunity to hear whatever the spiels, you know, spiritualists would say to try to get someone on board.
Yeah, and they did everything they could. He got the ultimate curse because Walter, the ghost brother of Mina, went ahead and cursed him for the rest of his life that he was going to have untold bad fortune and all this good stuff. Well, in response to Walter's curse, Houdini went ahead and posted a pamphlet to the masses with drawings of how she does all of her parlor tricks and how she pulls everything off, just basically debunking her entire act. And if that wasn't far enough, Houdini then started to travel with his show and perform her tricks stage in front of everybody coming to see his act, just ripping her apart. Which, to me, that's the ultimate fuck you. Like, oh, you're pretty good at this. I'm going to jump on stage and I'm going to show everybody how you do it.
Mess with a guy's mom, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it was necessarily, I mean, Mina, I don't think caught that fire as much as it was just like she was probably so bad at doing it and it was so obvious to him. He almost felt like he wanted to let everybody else know.
I was going
to
say, do you think that he probably thought it was an insult for her to be even considering like that her thing was even remotely close to his field?
That was, like, could also be, to him. I didn't think about that, but it's almost like he felt she was mocking what he does.
Yeah, it was cheapening what he did.
So in turn, he mocked her back.
So what ends up happening, so he has the curse by August put against him. And then what's this thing down at the bottom you have here? I can't read that.
The first curse was the rest of his life. Mm. And after he's doing these shows and just going up on stage and making a fool of Mina, her supporters and the spiritualists, like, start to follow him around and picket him and are, like, throwing bricks through hotel windows that he's staying at. Like, the violence is ratcheting up. They're getting very mad. Mm-hmm. And that's when Walter makes his second proclamation. And his second proclamation is that Houdini's days are numbered, and this was in August, and that he will be dead by Halloween, which is a very vague threat. And you throw enough shit at the wall, eventually something's going to be right. But how right they were is where I think this really takes off into a crazy conspiracy.
This is why I want to cover the death first before, or cover this stuff first leading up to it before we got into this death. So leading up, I think a couple days before his death, he is in Detroit.
He starts out at McGill University, which I believe is in Montreal.
Okay. So he's in Montreal. He breaks his ankle either during that show or before, right before?
I think it was during that show. Okay, he broke it during the milk can trick. Okay,
so he breaks his ankle during that show. Now, he's not a guy to take time off. So his next job is Detroit. And he also starts running 102 degree temperature. So usually you break your ankle, you're not going to start running a fever unless there's something else up. They go to Detroit, I think like 2 days later. And he's going to perform in Detroit.
Oh, you're skipping over the real fun part.
Okay, sorry, go.
So when he's up in Montreal at McGill, he does not a show and tell, but he meets with people at McGill University and kind of explains like his tricks of the trade. Not his tricks, but
is it
like,
McGill or Concordia?
McGill.
Okay.
Was the university. And he's just kind of, I think, explaining showmanship and all that. They invite, I think it was three students backstage, and one of
them... Okay, I thought this occurred in Detroit. Okay, no. Go.
Yeah. So one of them wanted to paint a portrait of him, which, weird, but back then probably not the weirdest thing ever. And this douche that showed up back there, his name was Jocelyn Gordon Whitehead. Mm-hmm. A man named Jocelyn is never a man you can trust.
Do you know what's weird about this, too? So he shows up to return a book that Houdini had lent him a couple days prior.
Maybe that was from the McGill University thing.
Okay.
That could have been from that.
Yeah, so he shows up to return this book. Did you hear what he was asking him?
Yeah, he asked him if he could really sustain as much damage as he said he could.
Before that, before he did that, he was asking him questions about, like biblical questions, questions of belief, like, in God and things like that. So he was asking him kind of some, like, not off-the-wall questions, but deep. Kind of, yeah. And, like, one of his follow-up questions. And again, at this time, Houdini's got a broken ankle. He's literally sitting on a couch.
Getting painted.
Yeah, like laying on a couch. And this whitehead guy, he's like, hey, is it really true that you're able to, like, take hard punches? Was that ever, like, that's something that you don't hear about. But you always see it in, I was trying to explain it. Remember, like, the circus sideshow would have the guy that caught the cannonball, the big dude? So was this ever something like, because if he was known for this, at what point in his show is he just like, I need a volunteer to punch me in the gut?
I don't necessarily think that it was like volunteer for punches, but he would put his body through all these different kinds of feats of strength. And it may have been punches. It may have been the cannonball trick. I don't know. But he had some sort of superior ability.
That it was widely known that he could absorb damage or something. I don't know.
Well, and he was built like a little brick shit house. That's true. He was a tough guy. And this, to me, when I hear it, it's totally like, this is when you ask a professional wrestler, like, hey, are you really that tough? And they're like, yeah. Well, the reason why professional wrestling can look so real is because these guys know, like, how to take and receive punishment. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to get kicked in the stomach, if you're going to take, like, a round kick in martial arts and you're supposed to, you know that you're supposed to flex your muscles, so you take that brunt. But then after you get hit, knowing that you're going to get hit, you let the force carry your body. Like, you don't push against it.
So no, you almost like start the momentum in the direction that the kick is going to force you. So if you're going to get kicked, you're already almost traveling backwards.
You basically
To try to match the speed that the kick is coming. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a total protection method. And after McGill asked this, or not McGill, but after Jocelyn asked this, he goes, yeah, I can do that. Jocelyn just starts throwing hammer fists at his stomach. Like, there wasn't a prep time or anything like that.
They
just
started swinging on him. Yeah, they said it as he's laying there on the couch. He literally just, like, starts punching him below the belt on his right side.
Which, you're not flexed up. You're not ready for it. And how do you... That's
you're sitting there relaxed with your broken ankle up.
Yeah, you're probably on pain meds at that point.
I don't even know if he was on pain meds at that point. Were there pain meds at this point? Like, oh, yeah. Opium? It was just opium?
Opium. Cocaine was an analgesic at some point, but like this was back when the good stuff was the pain medication.
See, here's the other thing too, is I don't know if he seems like the kind of guy that would just take that and still be performing. He seems like such a stickler and like a master and has respect for what he does, knowing the danger of it, that I think if he was going to take, you know, opium, something like that, he would take it, but then as soon as he found out what kind of state of mind it's going to put him in, I don't think he's going to be performing. My theory is that he's not on really any type of pain medication.
Yeah, and maybe it was just he was more focused on his ankle to try to tense up or take a punch.
But like, someone just goes over and, like, you're laying there getting fucking a picture drawn of you and just, like, just haymakers right on your right side. So finally, after the fourth, he tells the guy to knock it off. Like, he's like, that's good. That's fine.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like a panic thing.
He's no, like, it wasn't even like, what the fuck are you doing? It's like, I'm good. You're good. Like,
you're going to start hurting your hands.
Are you satisfied? You happy now? So that ends up happening. He goes out and he performs that night. And then he goes to Detroit, right? Yep. So when he gets to Detroit, at this point, he's running 104 degree temperature. And ends up passing out on stage.
Well, the doctor came beforehand.
That's right.
And saw him. Mm-hmm. And
I'm so excited. I just keep skipping
ahead. Yeah. Bess said, I think he's probably hurting because he took all these punches in the stomach. So that could be the issue, which I think maybe he kind of fooled himself into his pains that way, too.
Trying to be like, I'm hurting because of that.
Yeah. I got punched here. That's why it's hurting. Well, Doc says, this looks like appendicitis. We probably need to get you in and get surgery on you right away. Yeah. And back then, appendicitis was a fixable procedure. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't a high mortality rate if you could catch it at the right time.
If you caught it and got it taken care of when it was appendicitis.
Mm-hmm. Before it ruptures, before you go septic. And he basically tells the doctor to pound sand. He's going to get out there.
The show must go on.
Yeah. Consummate showman. I mean, the guy sacrificed a lot. And like you said, ends up going out on stage. He craps out and passes out on stage, I think somewhere around the second act.
Comes to, finishes the show.
Did he?
Yes.
Jeez.
Then goes to the hospital. So by the time he gets there and they're able to get him open, so we probably listened to or read different information too, which is nice when we can do that. They said that when they went to go make the initial incision to get him cut open, like pus started coming out.
Ooh, that's usually a bad sign.
Like a lot. And so as they got him open, they had discovered that his appendix had burst and there was like gangrene. So they pulled out the gangrenous appendix and everything. And then they said they just stitched him up.
Didn't clean up anything.
I don't know what the dude we're talking about, you know, 1926. Like think of what, go back in your head and think of like World War One medical tents, like what they're doing. It's literally like you got gangrene, bite down on this stick, we're sawing the leg off.
Yeah, we're just going to take the leg.
You can't do that to your internal organs. No, they can't get in there and really scrape out stuff without nicking you or bleeding out. So basically what they're relying on and what they had to rely on at this point is we're going to go ahead and get you sewn up and start getting whatever type of antibiotics or treatment we have into you at this point. And after they said for a couple days, he kind of started to go on the upswing.
Yeah, he had a decent amount of time from, I think it was on the 24th is when he collapsed on stage, and October 24th, and they went in, and I guess they removed his appendix mm-hmm. and all that. And so he ended up fighting and living from the 24th till Halloween.
Yeah.
So from the 24th to the 31st, he was still fighting.
I want to say 24th is when he collapses. Surgery took place 25th or 26th, something like that. And the time frame they say was he lasted 2 or 3 days. He was good for like 2 days. And then I guess he started to go downhill at that point. But yep, ends up dying on October 31st, Halloween, 1926 in Detroit.
I think that would be the way he would want it. I don't know what Halloween really was back then, but it always kind of feels like it has that vibe of like...
It's easy to say that now, but he's like, fuck no.
Yeah, he didn't want to die.
No. You think that's how he wants to like... Come on, man. Like, that's how he wants to go out? What happened? I got punched in the stomach a bunch of times, my appendix burst, and then I ended up dying.
Yeah, that's not a good way to go out.
He would have wanted to go out, it would have been during a trick, I would have imagined.
I think he would have been too vain for that. I don't think he would have wanted that, because that means that he didn't complete his trick.
Maybe the trick if it's designed for him to die.
Well, and this sort of leads into...
Have you ever watched... You have never watched The Prestige, have you? Mm-mm. Okay. So, and I'm not saying that this... It borrows from Houdini in real life, but it's a competition between two magicians. One of them meets Tesla and designs this trick where through, like... It you know the thing that you see the like the electricity ball that's shooting out all the sparks
yeah.
and electrical currents? So it's like that, except it connects to, it goes, the guy goes into a chamber and all that surrounds him. He disappears, but what the trick ends up being, and this is where it gets into kind of far-fetched, like made-up stuff, it clones him. And then, yes, so just listen. That's how obsessed he is with pleasing the audience. The guy that goes into the machine that the electricity surrounds, he gets dropped into the Chinese water tank thing.
Oh, yeah.
It locks him in. That guy drowns. And then the clone appears in the back of the audience where it, like, creates him and really? Teleports him. And he's like, I'm here. So this guy's act in the movie is basically his well-known trick involves him, the guy on stage, being willing to die for the trick to... And so they show a warehouse at the very end, and he's got all these tanks with, like, just dead bodies. Of himself floating in it. That's where he keeps him.
Clones himself every time.
It's the clone that gets to then go the next act. And yeah. And that clone dies and it creates it, but it has all of his memories.
It's just like he regenerates into a clone.
And I realize that that's a bunch of horseshit. It's a fucking movie, of course. But what I'm just saying is that, like, the way this guy, you know, lived, breathed, ate, slept, all this stuff, I feel like had he got to the end of the road, his desire would have been to design a trick that... If he died doing it, he might not have been that upset. This is just not his ideal way of doing it, is what I'm getting at.
I think it sort of lent to a little bit of help, too. because there were rumors and conspiracy theories that this was all one big last trick, that they were going to bury him and then he was going to emerge from.
He did that once. He did a buried alive trick. Yeah.
They thought, and I don't know how well this was like accepted, but they believed that that could have been the trick, was that he was going to rise from the dead after that and perform his greatest feat. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. And he set some things in place before he died with Bess. And basically just as another fuck you to the spiritualist community. And there were questions about it. They thought that there's a good chance that the dude named Jocelyn was a spiritualist. And he was sent in to do the bidding of them to try to kill him because they wanted Walter to be right. So this was kind of right around that time that it fits that whole mold.
Do you think... I see some merit to that with it being... Because the testimony, too, about the questions that he was asked doesn't just come from, like, Bess and Houdini in the room. It comes also from the two other students, I think, that were in the room, too. Mm-hmm. That explains the questions that he was being asked, like the religious questions. I could see that being... those questions and then him punching him, maybe like as a way to try to send a message, because
kind of like a message just between those two.
Yeah. Cause they didn't have an idea that cause he had appendicitis before this, of course. It's not like getting punched can cause appendicitis.
Yeah. This wasn't a cause and effect thing. This was something that already had happened.
Here's the other thing too, is that there is also talk that had that not happened, him getting hit, he may not have gone to and had the doctor come to take a look at him. So and the end result could have been the appendix bursting without him knowing, him still not being able to, you know, recover from the surgery. But I think there is some merit. I like to put on my tinfoil hat and imagine that they're probably, if the spiritualist community, you know, had a bone to pick and was willing to go far enough to send someone in there to be like, just send him a message. You're not looking to kill him or anything like that, but let him know we mean business. Was it like, did he whisper to me? He's like, the spiritualists send their regards.
Yeah, this is from your buddy Arthur Conan Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good time. Have a good show.
Artie says hello.
There was that theory. There was a theory to the spiritualist poisoning him, which that seems like pretty far out there. I would probably lend credence to the boy named Jocelyn being probably a higher conspiracy theory as far as believability. Because poisoning somebody back then, you're traveling so much, unless you have somebody that you've gotten to on the inside that can slowly feed him poison. Poisoning doesn't cause appendicitis, so that wouldn't be something that would have led to it either.
It's most likely just a coincidental series of events.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
His failsafe that he put in place, and I think this was probably when he was in the hospital, if he was awake and talking to Bess, he said, for the next 10 years after I die, you hold a seance. And you invite a spiritualist to try to get a hold of me.
If there's any way, shape, or form that I can reach out to you, I will.
We have a coded message. Mm-hmm. And that coded message was a song that they loved or something like that.
Yeah, it was something that only they would know.
And so every year after he died for 10 years, she would carry this out.
On Halloween.
Was it on Halloween?
Mm-hmm. He said, every year on the anniversary of my death, I want you to try to reach out to me. There was one occurrence in that 10 years that she says that she may have believed, but that there was too much doubt.
Like she led him towards finding what.
It got close, but it's still at the end of the 10 years, there's actually audio recording of the guy talking to her.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so she's talking, she says, and she's basically the gist of the message is he's like, the hour has ended. On the 10th year, hold on, I'm going to sneeze.
Bless you.
Sorry about that. He says the final hour has ended on the 10th year. This is the last attempt we will reach, Harry Houdini. You know, Bess, how do you feel? And she's like, after 10 years, I can say that he's not able to reach out. This doesn't work. That was basically what the gist of it was. But can you imagine, imagine it actually did work, he passed on or whatever, and he's in the afterlife and she starts doing the seance and he's like, fuck, I can hear her. And he's just sitting out there and he's like, I hate these motherfuckers, and if I try to answer her back with the message, it's gonna just support that this is actually real and my whole vendetta and mission that I went against these guys. So for 10 years he's sitting there, and every Halloween he's just like, god damn it.
This is the only person in the world I want to talk to, but I have to admit that
all these motherfuckers around him, around her, he's like, just do it one more year, Bess, without any of these people here on Halloween. Try to reach out to me.
Yeah, you try it yourself. Something, just don't let them know that I know that this was legit.
How many messages on foggy mirrors when you've been taking a bath, steamy mirrors, do I have to send you? I'm trying to reach out. I can't do it in front of these people.
Yeah, and she even admits, too, that the one time that the spiritualist got close, she said that, like I say, she said that she felt like she was leading him into giving the code up. But she full-on admitted, she goes, I did it because I miss him.
I was going to say, I could see that happening. Like, imagine, like, you're around, like, year 7 or 8, and you're like, I'm past the halfway point. I'm got a few of these left. Maybe if I try to, yeah, you'd miss someone. You would at that point maybe try to even like let your guard down and let your skepticism, you know, down and just be like, let's see if we can get close to it. If it's something that can maybe give me some hope or some peace. But at the end of it, she was like, yeah, you probably wouldn't have wanted that.
No. And that's, we still see that today. Like we were talking about a couple of days ago with that butthole that does crossing over.
Oh, John Edwards.
Yeah. John Edwards, the Long Island medium lady. All those people that claim to be mediums to try to do that, that's their sole moneymaker, is to hope that there is somebody out there that's so weak that just wants one more talk with their husband, one more talk with their mom.
It's just a study of psychology. It's exactly what I think you even pointed this out. It's just asking such open-ended and vague questions that it could possibly apply to 90% of your audience. And then once somebody raises their hand, you're like, okay, what can I tell about this person from how they look? This person is probably in their 50s, which means they probably have a dead parent. And that's kind of what that was. I wonder what the outtakes of those shows would look like. Because you know they're only showing the ones that end up working out.
I told you about that. They're on YouTube. They're called Medium Fails. And it's people going into these audiences, or like they'll go on like a morning show and try to do it. And so basically the grift is they'll start out, they'll say that they have a feeling coming from maybe this side of the room or that side of the room.
I'm getting a D. Does anyone have anyone close to them that starts with a D? My grandfather's name was Darren.
Well, and once you get that information, you can start reading them down and breaking them down. Like you're talking about, you're psychoanalyzing. You're looking at how young they are. Mm-hmm. If they mention, well,
it's characters. It's like spur of the moment character study.
Yeah. That's my husband, Charles. You look at her, she's 25. Mm-hmm. Immediately. Your next question after that is Charles passed. Yes. And then they say yes. And you go,
unexpectedly.
It was untimely. And you say, well, yeah, he died in a car accident. And then you go, yeah, he wants you to know. Once you get the news of the car accident,
once those eyes lock in and you see that look of like, oh, I'm strapped in, I'm along for the ride.
Well, and once you get to something like that, like if it's a major wreck or something, your next feeling after that is you either continue to dig, which probably isn't going to get you more, or you end it.
You're going to show your hand if you try to dig too much, because then you're going to have to come up with specifics.
So you cut it off immediately and you say, I just want you to know that he wants you to know that the money is going to be okay, that it's going to be there. Because you go through a car wreck, you go through some sort of a change in life, you're probably going to have like two worries in your life. And that's providing for your family and being able to live a life that you want to live.
You're playing the odds of percent. You're playing the law of percentages.
Yeah. But when you get one where somebody fucks it up, it's golden to see them try to backpedal and be like, oh, actually, that might be somebody else from the crowd. Or if they ever say like, I see somebody in your family, it starts with a J, and they're like, Jim. He's like, yeah, Jim passed away. And the guy's like, no, I saw Jim this morning. He's my brother. And they're like, must have been like another J name.
A James. Is there a James farther along in your family?
To watch these people just struggle and realize like, oh, shit, this is a bad one. I have to cut this off immediately. Mm-hmm. It's the best panic that you can see.
We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
If you get Ty, I'll send you the videos. Dude, it is so funny to watch them fail. And all it is just them fucking up preying on somebody else. Because if you get one or two of those right, and you get those people to come back or go buy your shit book, that's all you have to do is get that book sold one time. Because then you have all that money from that. Yeah. And you can be wrong, you know, 90% of the time. But as long as you nail those 10% and that's what's on camera, you're good to go.
Yep. All right, man. You got any other thoughts on this?
No. I like Houdini. We didn't go super deep into Houdini because we were more looking towards the conspiracy and his fight with the spiritualists. fascinating man. He was a movie star for his time. He,
I wouldn't say he was a movie actor in his time. His movies were like, he made two, and the consensus is that they were just horrible.
Oh, they probably weren't good, but he was still Houdini. That's true. He was still larger than life.
That's character. True. He was his, I think he was his own production company too, because he was so rich. He was also, just a little tidbit, he was a pilot, and he was the first person to fly a motorized airplane in Australia. That's so, just a weird thing to think about.
Yeah, and it's those things that we didn't really get into because we wanted to focus more on the conspiracy.
He kind of seems like a Howard Hughes type person. Just instead of like aviation, you know, being his primary focus, it was, you know, entertainment in a way.
And he was very good at what he did, whether it be maybe not great as a movie star, but he knew how to raise his star power. Again, for a guy with a third grade education, I know we talked about it, like education probably wasn't great back mm-hmm. then, but that's a lot of drive to be able to take the little bit that you know and coming from meager beginnings to having the empire that he did.
Yeah, exactly. And still being known today, which, I mean, of course, he doesn't know that. Or does he?
He might. Hey, mm-hmm. he might still be alive. We don't know. Maybe the spiritualists were right.
No. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us for another episode, and see you later.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit him with it.
Our Instagram is historicallyhighpod, historicallyhighpod, and we are on Twitter at historicallyhigh, that's historicallyhi.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.